Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with For the Record program number 214. This is a follow-up to a program done a couple of years ago entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters. As I'm recording this on March 19th of the year 2000, we are once again experiencing an enormous rise in gasoline prices, this due to a, quote, oil shortage, unquote. And once again, consumers are tearing their hair, and once again, we face the prospect of across-the-board inflation because, of course, everything is directly or indirectly dependent on the price of petroleum. And once again, this figures to be a major political football in a presidential election year with one of the Republican nominees' names, last names, being Bush. Actually, first and last names being George Bush. In 1979, as the 1980 campaign was gearing up, George Herbert Walker Bush was running for president. He eventually became Ronald Reagan's vice president, eventually president himself, and knowledgeable political analysts will tell you that George Herbert Walker Bush was the real power behind the throne. And Ronald Reagan found out when he took a bullet from Bush family-associated American Nazi John Hinckley Jr., whose father, John Hinckley Sr., was one of George Bush's main primary campaign backers. That's discussed, by the way, in a miscellaneous archive show entitled George Bush and the Shooting of Ronald Reagan. We have been talking about a remarkable and sadly underpublicized book entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. This book was co-authored by Mark Loftus and John Ahrens, published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. John Loftus is a former career military officer and former Justice Department investigator with a very high security clearance, and he was able to get power of attorney for a number of veteran U.S. and British intelligence agents who contributed to the book under condition of anonymity. They are known as the Old Spies. In addition, the book is copiously footnoted. This 510-page book has 135 pages of footnotes. That's 510 pages of text, 135 pages of footnotes. The book has not received a lot of publicity. I think the title has a lot to do with it. The Secret War Against the Jews really might have been better titled Petroleum Industry, Fascism, and the Intelligence Community, because it really focuses more on the intelligence community and fascism and the petroleum industry than anything else, although obviously those are inextricably linked, too, with the history of the Jews, or the modern history of the Jews. A lot of people, I think, have avoided the book because they say, I don't want to read about Jews. I don't like Jews. Well, think about how much you're paying for gasoline and then ask yourselves whether you might want to read this book. Perhaps you might even want to Xerox off some of the key pages from the chapter I've been reading from and fax them to talk show hosts so that they can get this information on the air. We've been talking about the fact that the CIA under George Herbert Walker Bush deliberately manufactured phony petroleum production figures both for the Soviet Union and elsewhere, and that this in turn resulted not only in the scare that the Soviet Union was going to run out of oil and either buy oil from the Middle East or attack the Middle East, this resulting not only in consumer acquiescence to higher gasoline prices, but also in an enormous arms buildup, arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and ultimately, as we're going to read, the, quote, gas shortage, unquote, of 1979 that had consumers tearing their hair. The inflation resulting from the petroleum increases of the 1970s helped to destabilize Jimmy Carter. The oil crisis, quote, unquote, of 1979 helped to destabilize Jimmy Carter. In particular, it deep-sixed his chances in California. Ronald Reagan, of course, was former governor of California. And note again that this CIA, the phony oil scare from one element of the CIA, was midwifed by George Bush when he was director of the CIA. Note that his son, of course, George W. Bush, also an oil man, is currently running for president on the Republican ticket, and we've talked about George W.'s connections to Saudi oil interests and the intelligence community through James R. Bath, among others. Among other things, the Texas business representative for the Bin Laden family. That's the family of Osama Bin Laden. Speaking of the, quote, Red Scare, unquote, and the phony study by the CIA that the Soviets were going to run out of oil and all of the impacts that had on politics in the 1970s, in particular the destabilization of the Carter administration, the Carter energy conservation policies, which the oil industry opposed. They favored oil consumption, not oil conservation, and they got their wish with an increase in oil prices by the phony oil shortage. Eventually, this led James Schlesinger to resign as Energy Secretary. We're going to resume the narrative with Loftus and Aaron's writing about that as follows. The Red Scare had an impact on Carter's Energy Secretary, James Schlesinger. From the very start of the false CIA reports on Soviet and Saudi oil production, Schlesinger had disagreed strenuously with the revisionist predictions, as had his ex-CIA aides. But by the time he departed his post in August of 1979, Schlesinger was beating a very familiar Cold War drum. In fact, he seemed to have changed his whole tune. Over the next few years, he became one of the loudest voices supporting the Reagan administration's push to make Saudi Arabia the main force in protecting Middle Eastern oil supplies. As he left office in 1979, Schlesinger, like Admiral Turner, by the way, that's former CIA director at Stansfield Turner, and the president, was obsessed with the Soviet menace to the Saudis, the very premise of the whole CIA forgery. Schlesinger declared that, quote, "The United States must protect its oil interests in the Mideast with a military presence capable of balancing the Soviet Union's nearby forces," unquote. Although he tried to inject a sense of a brand new red threat, it sounded like the same rhetoric James Forrestal had used three decades earlier. And then there's a quote here from a press account of the time. Schlesinger, in a farewell speech Thursday at the National Press Club, warned that, quote, "Soviet control of the oil tap in the Middle East would mean the end of the world as we have known it since 1945 and of the Association of Free Nations," unquote. The dependence of the United States and its industrial allies on Mideast oil has injected a dangerous new element in the long-standing power contest between the United States and the Soviet Union, said the departing energy secretary. And he added, "The United States cannot ever again expect to produce all of the oil and natural gas it needs." Unfortunately for Schlesinger, then the Loftus and Aarons go on to add here, unfortunately for Schlesinger, he had been too persuasive in his earlier arguments. The experts still agreed that the CIA figures were wrong. It was a little late to try to convert them to the imminent Soviet threat. Even the Soviets had more credibility in debunking the CIA's theories. A few months after Schlesinger quit, the Oil and Gas Journal, a specialist energy magazine, published a lengthy article by a leading Soviet economist. It was unusual for a respectable magazine to publish communist propaganda, but as the editor noted, quote, "Because of the controversy over future production capabilities of the Soviet Union, this article is presented in order to place the precise Soviet position on the record," unquote. The article was the sort of propaganda to be expected from an economist working at Moscow University during this neo-Stalinist time. It completely dismissed the CIA's most recent forecast of a Soviet oil crisis, which, quote, "creates the impression that the CIA people think mostly about the political effect of their forecasts and are not troubled by the fact that they have nothing to do with reality," unquote. The article sets out the facts from the Kremlin, stressing that the Soviets would produce almost 600 million tons of oil in 1979 and would continue to outproduce both Saudi Arabia and the United States. By the way, I would add, this isn't Stalinist propaganda. This actually was true. Continuing. Even when hampered by the very severe winter of 1978 and 79, Soviet oil production had remained unaffected and, quote, "There are absolutely no grounds for the CIA to allege that in the 1980s the Soviet Union will become a major oil importer," unquote. Actually, I shouldn't say this is absolutely true, but the Soviet Union was never in danger of running out of oil. Russia still isn't. In fact, Russian and former Soviet oil-producing areas are very hot corporate potatoes, even as I speak, on 3/19/2000. There's a particular analysis by the Soviets was not absolutely accurate, but the notion that they were about to run out of oil is readily verifiable nonsense, even at the time and certainly many years later. Continuing, according to Moscow, quote, "Such forecasts can be explained only by the CIA's desire to back the assertion about the Soviet menace to U.S. oil interests in the Middle East and to make the public believe that the USSR is threatened by the same energy crisis now ravaging the West. the Soviet Union develops its energy industry on a basis which has been and will be independent of foreign crude and products. The Soviet Union also will continue fuel exports to the West, including crude oil. Of course, there is a significant element of propaganda. The Soviets were very much concerned with the price of oil. Keeping the price of crude relatively high was the key to their economy. Continuing, as later on when the price of oil fell in the 80s, it helped to undermine them. Continuing, Loftus and Ahrens add, nevertheless, the barrage of criticism had only a minor effect on those who were producing the phony intelligence estimates. By early 1980, at the beginning of another presidential election year, the CIA slightly downgraded the scope of the looming Soviet oil crisis. But it still predicted, quote, that by 1985, the USSR would be importing more than 2 million barrels of oil a day, equivalent to 6.6% of current output by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, unquote. The problem for the electorate was simple. Whose propaganda to believe, the Soviet Union's or the CIA's? The debate became quite heated at times. There was certainly a great disparity in the argument, even over basic facts. One independent study estimated Soviet oil reserves at, quote, 150 billion barrels, just a little under Saudi Arabia's. The CIA puts the figure at between 30 and 35 billion barrels, unquote. Yet as time went by, the facts seemed to count less and less. In April of 1980, CIA head Turner went on a major offensive. A strong supporter of the CIA's analysis of Soviet oil problems from the very beginning, he claimed that any development towards Soviet dependency on oil imports would cause a major disruption of the U.S. economy, unquote. Even worse, the communists would upset the balance of power in the Middle East by offering to sell weapons to the Arabs in return for reduced oil prices. The clear implication was that the United States had to preempt the Soviet threat by selling more arms to the Arabs while buying less oil. Admiral Turner, who seems to have spent most of his years at the CIA thoroughly loyal to, if totally misled by, his own employees, was as certain as Forrestal and Schlesinger about the red threat to Middle Eastern oil interests. His analysts' predictions about the imminent collapse of the Soviet oil industry completely convinced him. According to our sources, Turner was what was called a useful idiot, unquote. Despised by the rank and file, he was only nominally in control of the CIA and was completely unwitting that many of the files he was fed by his staff were forgeries. Encouraged by some Chinese disinformation, Turner truly believed that the Soviets were getting ready to attack across the desert in 1980. The fact is that the CIA reports on the Soviet threat were as false as they were frightening. As one of our sources put it, quote, look, the Soviets couldn't even hang on to their puppet colony in Afghanistan. They were bleeding themselves white. At one point during the Afghan War, the military was consuming nearly 28% of the gross productivity of the Soviet Union. The last thing the Kremlin wanted was all-out war with the Muslim world. They couldn't finance their own PLO hit squads, let alone start a second front in the Middle East. The whole idea of the Russian army marching into the Saudi oil fields was a fraud, unquote. And the Loftus and Ahrens continue, but the fraud worked. According to the Red Scare scheme, there was only one thing to do, arm the Arabs so they could defend the oil fields themselves. In September of 1980, less than 2 months before Ronald Reagan defeated a lame duck Jimmy Carter and was elected U.S. president, the CIA was still circulating its phony estimates of Soviet oil production. One CIA working paper reiterated the 1977 forecast, quote, that Soviet oil production would decline to between 8 and 10 barrels of oil a day by 1985 from its current production level of 12 million barrels daily, unquote. Coincidentally, in that same month, things seemed to be getting even more serious in the Middle East. The Iraq-Iran war was in full swing, and it was feared that the Soviets could take advantage in any moment. The Saudis already had the promise of the Pakistani units, but now they were thinking seriously of compulsory military training. In 1979, fundamentalists had led a terrorist raid on the Grand Mosque in Mecca. Fundamentalists who, like Jack Philby before them, were sick of the corruption oil money had brought to the kingdom. The bloody attack had rocked the royal family, and it feared both external subversion and internal dissent. Carter was receiving a great deal of criticism for not expanding the defense budget to meet the imminent Soviet threat. Already engulfed by the Iran hostages drama, Carter fought his losing battle for a second term. No president can go soft on communists in an election year. With the Soviet threat to Middle Eastern oil supplies now firmly entrenched in the public mind, the time was ripe for the anti-Israeli forces in Washington to begin dramatically boosting the Saudis' arsenal. Carter had already bent over backward to give the Saudis the F-15 fighter bomber, but in September of 1980, they also got their first experience of AWACS airborne warning and control systems. The AWACS were the most sophisticated aerial radar platform in the world, capable not only of defensive actions, but also of directing offensive operations. Because the AWACS net could neutralize the Israeli Air Force, the first four were only on loan from the United States, supposedly to keep an eye on developments in the Iran-Iraq war. Crown Prince Fahad apparently was impressed by these new toys. He wanted more, with no strings attached. As soon as Carter was out, he would get them. It was almost time to end the farce of the forged oil figures. As soon as Reagan took office, the CIA began to admit that its estimates had been wrong, drastically wrong. In March of 1981, less than 2 months into Reagan's term, the news was leaked to Marshall Goldman of Harvard University's Russian Research Center that the CIA had revised its forecasts of 1985 Soviet oil production to 11 million barrels a day, well above the panic figures of the 1970s. In effect, Goldman was announcing that under Carter, the CIA had grossly overestimated the extent of a real Soviet threat to Western oil interests in the Middle East. Goldman said the 1977 CIA report made catastrophic predictions on Soviet oil needs and raised the prospects of some potentially dangerous scenarios. Quote, "The original report implied that the Soviet Union needed to physically take possession of countries like Iran and Kuwait." Dr. Goldman said, the original report implied that the Soviet Union needed to physically take possession of countries like Iran and Kuwait, Dr. Goldman said, adding that revised projections took an edge off the idea of a Soviet compulsion to enter the area. The September 1980 CIA report declared that the Soviet officials were, quote, "trapped in a rat race of their own making," unquote, in regard to oil production. Although it noted that the Soviet Union has the world's largest oil reserves, the CIA report said substantial growth in the 1980s was not achievable because the new oil was found in difficult-to-tap areas and required massive amounts of capital and manpower to develop, unquote. The Reagan team was horrified at the leak and rushed in to rebuke any suggestion that the CIA figures had been cooked. Goldman was completely wrong, they said. If the Saudis were to get their AWACS, the public had to believe in the Soviet threat. "The Soviet Union will almost certainly become a net energy importer," unquote. Reagan's new defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, said the same month, adding, quote, "This must be viewed along with the Soviets' economic necessity for eventual access to Persian Gulf oil." I would add that Weinberger eventually became Secretary of Defense. Skipping down, about the oil shortage and the gas shortage at the pumps and its effect on the Carter administration, Loftus and Ahrens write as follows. Listen very carefully to what I'm about to read and reflect on what's going on in March of the year 2000 with George W. Bush running for president. Continuing and skipping down. "The cardinal sin of statesmanship is naivete. Carter and Turner never suspected that their own people would lie to them. The phony CIA oil reports completely fooled them. Don't you get it?" asked one of our sources, again quoting, "The gas shortage during the Carter administration was as phony as the CIA's prediction about the Soviet oil shortage. The goddamn Middle East was swimming in oil during the Carter administration, but less and less of it was shipped to America. For Christ's sake, there was so much oil in South America that they had to shut down refineries in the Caribbean to keep it away from the U.S., unquote. That quoting one of the old spies. Again, continuing, this source has a point. One of the largest refineries in the Western Hemisphere is located on St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Most of its capacity went unused during the Carter administration's oil shortage, unquote. Yet it was greatly expanded during Reagan's term, despite the world glut of oil and falling prices. Most of the old spies are adamant that the oil companies cut refinery production to cause as much damage to the Carter administration as possible. On the other hand, Daniel Yergin asserts that it was the Arab exporters who were cutting supplies to the refineries. By mid-1981, it was embarrassingly clear that all of the CIA's predictions upon which Carter had relied were completely false. Not only was there not an oil crisis, the whole industry had suddenly gone the other way. There was a world surplus of oil, not a shortfall. The CIA figures on Saudi oil were just as false as their Soviet production estimates. By June that year, the Saudi Arabian government had created an oil glut and was under intense pressure in the Arab world to cut its production. The Middle East was drowning in oil. In fact, the new Reagan administration was exerting considerable pressure on the Saudis to use their oil supplies in a price war against Libya. When Reagan asked, the Saudis were happened to open the spigots to oil fields that supposedly were dry. Radical Arab nations such as Libya were selling oil way above the Saudis' price, and the Saudis were determined to stabilize prices largely because any new oil shock, unquote, would jeopardize their own huge investments in the West, while spurring the West to a more rapid search for alternatives to Saudi oil. The last thing the Saudis wanted was a return to Carter's conservation and alternative energy policies. In return for cooperating with Reagan, the Saudis got to shop at the biggest arms bazaar in Middle Eastern history. Reagan and his advisors clearly decided that Saudi Arabia should become the most powerful nation in the Middle East. They used the same old excuse. The communists might march on the oil fields. Even into the early 1980s, with the CIA's forecasts in shreds, the Reagan team was pursuing basically the same policies based on the same false assumptions as its predecessor. There was a major difference between the Carter and Reagan terms, however. Carter's senior officials were deliberately misled by the CIA forecasts, while Reagan's advisors knew by this time that the CIA had retracted its previous estimates as false. Despite the collapse of the fundamental premise that oil shortages would force the Soviets to invade Saudi Arabia, the defense buildup continued. The Reagan administration had a profound influence on the balance of forces in the Middle East, tilting military power decidedly against Israel. In arguing the case for selling the AWACS to Saudi Arabia, the Reagan team stressed the Saudis' key role in providing a stable oil market. The AWACS were crucial to Saudi Arabia to help it guard its oil fields, unquote. One senior U.S. official put the matter very bluntly, quote, "There is no doubt that Saudi security is our security," unquote. In the autumn of 1981, Prince Fahad got his AWACS. By early 1983, the price of oil was falling and the United States was gloating, quote, "because it signifies the effective end of OPEC power." Note this, a bit premature here. By early 1983, the price of oil was falling and the United States was gloating because it signifies the effective end of OPEC power. Compared to the official OPEC benchmark price of $34 per barrel, the spot market price for Persian Gulf oil last week appeared to be in the $28 to $29 range. Meanwhile, the Russians lowered their price by $2.15 to $29.35, unquote, that quoting a contemporary media account. The Soviets didn't mind. After all, they had never imagined such profits. Oil had been selling at $14 per barrel before the CIA pulled its fraud on Carter. The Soviets, too, were laughing all the way to the bank. What the Reagan administration had done, according to most of our sources in the intelligence community, was change the tide of Middle Eastern affairs. where once Israel had been, quote, America's largest aircraft carrier, unquote, Saudi Arabia was now the designated superpower in the Middle East. It was a policy of more arms and more oil for everybody. The phony policy of selling guns to the Arabs to keep the Soviets out of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait was also good for American domestic politics, at least in the short run. Under the Republicans, lucrative arms factories sprouted in what had previously been rural Democratic states. The votes went where the jobs were. In the course of the Reagan-Bush administrations, the defense budget was increased to a point where more money was spent on arms than in all the wars in U.S. history combined. To accomplish this massive defense buildup, the Reagan-Bush administrations borrowed three times more money than all U.S. presidents combined. By the way, I would add that that is actually not true. That is only the Reagan administration. National debt was $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office, $2.6 trillion when Reagan left office, and well over $4 trillion when George Bush left office. So it's even more than that. Beginning again, to accomplish this massive defense buildup, the Reagan-Bush administrations borrowed three times more money than all U.S. presidents combined. The largest debt in American history was based on the faulty premise that the Soviet Union was going to attack the Middle East. And bear in mind again that George W. Bush, with the connections to Saudi oil interests that I've already mentioned, the son of George Herbert Walker Bush, who helped to manufacture this hoax, is now running for president on the Republican ticket, and guess what? The price of gas is soaring. And guess what else? This from the San Francisco Examiner of Sunday, March 12th of the year 2000. This is an article by David E. Rosenbaum of the New York Times, headlined, Politics Fuels Gas Price Debate, subtitled, Bush Sure to Pump 93 Tax Vote as by Gore as Hot Topic in Race. It reads in part as follows. Republicans in Congress have begun to blame the Clinton administration generally, and Vice President Al Gore in particular, for the recent jump in the price of gasoline, and that seems sure to become a hot issue in the presidential race. When prices started to rise, quote, the administration was asleep at the wheel, unquote, House Majority Leader Dick Armey, Republican of Texas, said last week. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican of Mississippi, referred to the 4.3 cents a gallon increase in the federal gasoline tax enacted in 1993 as, quote, the Gore gas tax, unquote, and told reporters it should be repealed. Senator Frank Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said flatly what was on the minds of many of his fellow Republicans, quote, this is going to be a big issue in the political campaign, unquote. That again from the San Francisco Sunday Examiner of March 12th of the year 2000. Turning back to what one of the old spies said, and I'm going to wrap the broadcast up with this quote. Don't you get it? Asked one of our sources. The gas shortage during the Carter administration was as phony as the CIA's prediction about the Soviet oil shortage. The goddamn Middle East was swimming in oil during the Carter administration, but less and less of it was shipped to America. For Christ's sake, there was so much oil in South America that they had to shut down refineries in the Caribbean to keep it away from the U.S., unquote. Well, listeners, as you queue up for the gas pumps, remember this, and remember it also when you vote in November. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.